I'm Sarika Mehta, sitting in for Dime Roberts, and this is Stage and Studio. You're listening to a song called Con Kids by Portland's Chinatown dance rock band, The Slants. Our guest today, Simon Tam, is the bassist for the band, The Slants. Simon Tam is also a speaker and activist, having given TED Talks on race and language. He has also recently published a book, Music Business Hacks, The Daily Habits of the Self-Made Musician, which is on sale now. Currently, his band has filed a lawsuit against the United States Patent and Trademark Office for rejecting the copyright of the band's name, The Slants. The office claims their name is racist against Asians. More on that in a moment.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's first start out with telling us a little bit about your band before we get to the lawsuit. But you are the only, as far as we know, all Asian American dance band, and you call yourselves Chinatown Dance Rock. So tell us about that first.
Well, it was kind of inspired by an Asian American hip hop group called the Notorious MSG, because they called themselves the original Chinatown Bad Boys. And I remember when I saw that, I thought that is such a cool sounding thing that it kind of made me rethink how we would describe our own music. And what's interesting about Chinatowns is that they often involve other Asian ethnicities that aren't just the Chinese community. It's often just kind of that entry point for a lot of Southeast Asian immigrants, and we tend to be kind of pan-Asian in that respect. And so it kind of reflected our band as well. I mean, I am Chinese and Taiwanese, but the ethnicities of my fellow band members come from all different parts of Southeast Asia. So it's just kind of a fun way to represent ourselves while sounding like kind of tough and cool.
Right, because there aren't a whole lot of groups like you. I mean, we were talking about Far East Movement is the only Asian American rap group out there, but otherwise,
as far as like mainstream, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but I mean, there are some other bands coming up that do like indie rock, or there certainly are. There's a whole collection of like YouTube stars that Asian Americans doing like acoustic covers and that sort of thing. But there's not a lot like synth pop, heavy rock kind of stuff like what we do. And maybe it's just our particular generation. We grew up in just that right time where we fell in love with Depeche Mode and The Cure and New Order and all these other great bands. And you know, but we loved the music, but we didn't see ourselves in it. And so for us, we wanted to just kind of craft that identity that others could relate to, especially people around our age and our generation who love that kind of new wave sound. But now we can have maybe a more culturally relevant one.
Exactly. In fact, I was curious how your audience has received your music. Your band was founded in 2006, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that was, you know, some time ago. So I'm curious how the audiences have changed, or what have you noticed about how the audience has received your music since then?
Well, we kind of like have an interesting audience. Like when we play in venues like clubs and bars and that sort of thing, there's a generation of people closer to our age who say, yeah, I remember growing up in the 80s. I love this kind of sound. And then we have a very young audience cultivated from us playing at anime conventions around the country who think it's a new sound. So it's kind of interesting because they didn't grow up with those bands. And so they're like, wow, you got a lot of synthesizers and keyboards and your rock music. So it's kind of funny to see how that plays out. But we're able to introduce those kind of younger audiences to some of our inspiration. So it's nice to kind of relive that and kind of get it out there. But I think over the last few years, especially those demographics have kind of been merging, because a lot of those anime audiences are getting older, and so they've kind of come to know us and liked our sound and how that's kind of evolved as well over the last few.
I was curious, I mean, your band is loved worldwide, so we can talk about, and we will, you know, the Asian American politics of this, but how have non-American audiences received your music?
Generally, it's been very widely received. People, I mean, I think first and foremost, we are a band and we play music, and we try and make it accessible to even those who don't necessarily share our experiences as far as like race. We want to make music that makes people move, and so I think people could definitely appreciate that. you know, the other part is, and this happened much more early on when we were just starting, people would kind of point out our ethnicities. Like when we show up at clubs, there were several times where people laugh at us. Like, what are all these Asians doing here? Oh, they have keyboards? That's so cliche. But when we started playing and, you know, we have a very bombastic, live, energetic show, our old lead singer used to breathe fire and do all these crazy things. And you would see their jaws drop and all of a sudden they stop laughing and they're like, wow, these guys are really serious. You know, we've had people come up and apologize for believing in these stereotypes about Asians playing keyboards and thinking that we're all like really quiet and reserved, and they just were blown away. And so it's really, to me, that was a lot of fun. It's just demolishing those stereotypes and allowing the music to speak for itself and to kind of give us a different kind of credibility with those audiences.
Is it hard actually to find gigs and set up venues? Because if there's a difference between the stereotype of people, what people think of your group versus what you actually are?
Early on, yeah, it was a little more difficult because people would make assumptions about what we did, even though I would straight out explain what the kind of music we played, and we had websites, MySpace back then, where you could listen to the music. Some venues were reluctant. They're like, well, I don't know if people would show up for a bunch of Asians. Even as recent as 2012, we were playing in Europe and someone called us Oriental music. And I was like, what does that even sound like? You know, because they just saw that our picture on a poster. And they were like, well, I didn't really know what Oriental music would sound like, but you guys really rocked, and so I really liked it. And it was kind of those, one of those weird situations where, like, did you just slap me in the face compliment me? But
yes.
Yeah, so I mean, it just, again, proving the existence of like microaggressions and that kind of thing. But, you know, it's been really fun to be able to use that as a way to kind of engage in these more meaningful discussions about our own identities.
I want to get to talking about the lawsuit in a moment, but I was curious, after you guys filed the lawsuit, have you noticed a change in audiences and fan base and things like that?
Well, a lot more Asian Americans voiced their support of our work, and that was really, really encouraging, really cool to see that they're saying, coming out in droves saying that, you know, our music doesn't disparage Asian Americans. We actually celebrate it. Got a lot of wonderful, encouraging letters from Asian Americans of all generations saying how they really liked that we were this bold portrayal of Asian American culture. And so that's been really neat. And at the same time, because we've been featured in a lot of non-traditional sources, like we were recently in a bunch of sports pages, like the sports section of USA Today, and we were on BBC and all these other places, we've been able to reach out to audiences that probably never would have even considered us before. So it's been kind of neat that people talk about it because they see this political interaction that's happening. There's definitely a shift in our culture where, you know, people still see race and culture as important messages, the things that people can identify with. And so we've been tapping into like a more news savvy audience. So that's been neat.
Right. Well, let's get to it. Your band has filed a lawsuit against the United States Patent and Trademark Office. Tell us the story of how all of that started.
Well, it started about 5 years ago. My attorney at the time recommended that we file a trademark for our band's name, which is actually pretty common, especially for artists who are kind of up and coming, who are kind of hitting the national scene. It's just to protect your brand, just like any business or anything like that. And so we went ahead and filed. But a couple months later, he calls me on the phone and he says, hey, there was an issue with your trademark application. And so I ask him, so, you know, what's the problem? And he's like, well, they denied it. They said, your name is disparaging to persons of Asian descent. And I remember sitting there thinking, and I was like, wait, do they know we're of Asian descent? And he's like, yeah, I think so. And I was like, do they know we play like Asian festivals or in the Asian media? And he's like, yeah, I think so. And I'm like, well, you know, I didn't even know there was a law against this. So what kind of evidence did they actually bring to show that we're offending Asian people? And he said, well, they used UrbanDictionary.com. And then there's this photo of Miley Cyrus pulling her eyes back in a slant-eyed gesture. And that's about it. And I was like, so they didn't find any Asians that were actually offended by what we did. They just found like white people who are offended, and they went to like
an
a
Urban
Wiki
Dictionary.
Source. Yeah. And he's like, yeah. And he's like, I think we should fight this thing. And, you know, that turned out to be a very, very long process that we're still involved with now. But it's kind of evolved over time, because originally we just kept fighting, saying, hey, we're not offensive. Here's a bunch of Asians to prove it. Here's a survey. Here's a dictionary expert. Here's all this stuff. They didn't care about any of that. And finally, we refiled our application. And we asked them, said, well, why, out of all these cases in the U.S., did you say our name was derogatory towards Asians, that the term slant is an inherent racial slur when it has never been done in the history of the U.S.? Almost 800 other applications for the term slant have been approved. Why did you choose this particular case as one that was disparaging to Asians? And their attorney said, he said there's no doubt – it is irrefutable that the applicant is Asian American. And he said, so in other words, if I were white, this would not have been an issue. He said his rationale was that because we're Asian, people automatically assume it's a racial slur and not think of the actual dictionary definition or the conventional definitions for the term slant. And so that's why we were denied. And he went on to say that we were actually too Asian about it. So he's like, well, you have pictures of Asians on your website. You have dragons on your album cover. And it's like, you have all these things showing how Asian you are. And I was like, well, yeah, those pictures are of our band. And we like to use artwork that celebrate our respective cultural heritages. But his reasoning was that the more Asian we became of being Asian, the more offensive we were, because people would automatically assume that it's a racial slur. And it, even if we said things like, well, our intention is to show our perspective or our slant on life as people of color, he's like, it doesn't matter. Your intentions don't matter in this case. It's all about what we think people will perceive.
And this is not the first time a group of a certain minority has tried to reappropriate or reclaim a term and kind of been rejected on this purpose for these kind of filings for trademarks. Isn't that correct? You were saying other groups have faced similar.
Yes, that's true.
Business owners and things like that.
There are probably terms I can't say on air.
So. Right.
but what I can say is that almost every imaginable racial slur that you can think of for Asian Americans has been registered as trademarks by white Americans. Those same trademark applications were rejected by whenever an Asian American applicant applied. And this has been the case for other terms, not just for Asian Americans, mm-hmm. but people from the LGBTQ community, from other communities of color. So I looked over – I mean, I've been studying this for 5 years now. And when you look at the history of this, the law that's in place that we're fighting against, in the past 70 years, it has been disproportionately affecting communities of color or marginalized communities, and disproportionately favoring those who tend to be white, who tend to be straight, and who tend to be very wealthy.
I'm Sarika Mehta, sitting in for Dime Roberts. You are listening to a song called Sour Love by The Slants. In studio, we have Simon Tam, bassist and founder of the dance rock band. We've been discussing the band's popularity and success and the origins of their lawsuit against the United States Patent and Trademark Office. This lawsuit began 5 years ago due to the rejection of the band's copyright application on the basis that their name is disparaging to Asians.
So what we're saying is that we have seen people who are filing these trademarks who are white are winning their cases or getting their trademarks, whereas the groups who are actually trying to reclaim or use certain terms are getting resistance along the way, and there is a reality to the time and money and energy that people can go forth with these kind of cases.
Definitely, because the whole rationale, the whole purpose, like of reclaiming or reappropriating icons or symbols or terms, that is an argument that's not accepted by the United States Patent and Trademark Office, no matter how widely accepted it is within those communities. The only exception, and it's a really big one, was the hip-hop group NWA. They actually have a trademark registration, but it's for the initials NWA, and you know, it obviously it stands for it's cleverly hides the N word in there. What's funny is that anybody who's familiar with NWA knows what those things, what those words stand for. And if you were to take the trademark office's logic that, hey, people who associate that group with that term, they'll automatically think of a racial slur. Why did they get theirs approved, but ours was rejected? If we're going to use
that's
that
what
same
I'm trying
kind of
to
logic,
understand.
So it's just a very inconsistent legal process, and it seems to be very subjectively applied. Because how can one person make that decision for other people? The examining attorney who's been working on our case for the past 5 years on behalf of the trademark office is white. And in the last 5 years, he has not consulted a single Asian American on this particular issue. The only people that have written reports or decisions on our case from the trademark office have been Caucasians. And that's the thing that is just mind-boggling to me, because there are Asian Americans in the building. There are very vocal Asian Americans that they can talk to. They could say, hey, what does Angry Asian Man say about this? Or what are these mm-hmm. newspapers? What are these, you know, there's a White House Department for Asian American
Pacific Islanders. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
Why don't you ask them what, you know, and the reason why is because all of those groups are in support of what we do. When we submitted our case, we said, hey, look, every single Asian American media source that's written about us believes that what we're doing is relevant, or at least important for the Asian American community to engage in.
In any case, I wanted to kind of hash out this issue of reappropriation a little bit more. It's something that I think we all understand and we all support, but it's not really that simple. Sometimes it's jarring. That is to say, I feel like it's taken me personally a lifetime to teach people outside of my group, my cultural group or generation or whatever the case is, why it is inappropriate to use certain terms with certain groups of people. And then at the same time, our groups are reclaiming them, but there doesn't seem to be this education towards outsiders about what the meaning of all of this is. So can you comment on that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, I think the people that like to reappropriate terms do it because they deliberately don't want outsiders to understand it, because they want it to be empowering for our communities and say, this is our particular space. And whether you understand it or not, you don't belong here. This is in a system that's overwhelmingly dominated by one particular culture, white culture. This is a particular space that's reserved for our respective communities. And I mean, I think it is something that's complicated, but it's something that deserves consideration, like many complex issues. You know, for me, I think of it like this, that, you know, I think that our particular trademark office case represents it's a very clear example of systemic racism. I mean, you have a government body on public record saying that they're denying us a right because of my race. I mean, you can't get more explicit than that. Yet they refuse to think of it as racist. They think they're protecting Asian Americans. However, racism doesn't have to fit our stereotype of what it is in order for it to be racist. But I also think that our tools, our mechanisms for fighting and dismantling systemic racism don't necessarily have to fit our stereotype of what social justice looks like either. You know, when we started our particular ban, we just had this tremendous outpouring from Asian Americans who were proud, who said for the first time they actually felt proud of the fact that they had slanted eyes, and that they were really excited to kind of reclaim it. And also for us, when we approached non-Asian American audiences, it allowed us to create a point where we can create some more meaningful discussions around race and identity. I mean, I understand that not everybody gets it and not everyone supports it, but at least we can have those conversations in a meaningful manner where we could talk about our experiences in a way that people might not traditionally understand it as race or racism.
Especially, you mentioned talking about elders in our community who have learned about your band, about the music, and about the name. You know, they didn't have a space like when you performed for former Japanese interns and things like that who suffered in the internment camps.
Correct.
Tell that story.
Yeah, I mean, the probably one of the most inspirational moments of my music career was playing for internment camp survivors and them approaching me saying, like, number one, they thought their grandkids would love it. And I'm like, why aren't they here? But also for them telling me that they were proud that there was a new generation of Asian Americans who weren't afraid to take racism on, who weren't afraid to turn these stereotypes upside down, and that it made them so just filled with joy to see that there are people who aren't going to take what the system delivers, which, I mean, we live in a system that the government essentially likes to define our identities. They create these labels for us. And we said, you know, we're going to take our own route. We decide what we like to call ourselves or how we identify ourselves. Even just last year, I met George Takei, and he thought that he said our work was brilliant, and which, you know, I didn't even know what to say about that. I was like, George Takei said we're cool. So, you know, done. Drop the mic.
Stamp of approval. And it's not only elders who have survived those circumstances and didn't have a space to take on these terrible systemic challenges, but also young people have looked up to the band and finding an identity.
You know, so because a lot of times we're on the road and we do workshops and panels and that sort of thing, I talk about my experiences of being bullied as a kid. I mean, physically assaulted. You know, I still have scars on the top of my head when I was bashed in with a rock. And so these students come in and they can relate to the things we're saying and they find strength in it and solidarity. And so it is wonderful to be able to connect with Asian Americans of all ethnic backgrounds and of all generations and finding purpose and meaning in saying that we want to claim the space as our own and we want to do something about it while having some fun dance music to it.
Absolutely. I was curious, speaking of all of these issues we've just been discussing, on this show on APA Compass, we are often chatting with different Asian American artists who have to negotiate doing their art for the sake of art or for the sake of the love of the art. And also, they have to negotiate being slotted into this niche, into this label, kind of like what you were talking about at the beginning, like, well, we don't know how we feel about having a bunch of Asian Americans on a stage playing music. And this can be very stifling. So I was wondering if, beyond what you had started telling us at the beginning, if you've had other experiences with this or if you struggle with that.
I mean, we've certainly come across our challenges, but that was primarily in the beginning before we kind of became more established in our industry. You know, 2 years into this, we were approached by a very major label who had a very lucrative offer, but they wanted me to replace our singer with a white singer instead. They said Asian Americans don't sell. And it's just so there have been some very explicit
experiences. They were that blunt about it?
Yeah, that's what goodness. They said. You know, and then a couple of years later, of course, the YouTube sensations just took over, proving them wrong. Far East Movement charted on billboards, proving them wrong. But people still hold this belief. I mean, if they didn't, you would see many more Asian Americans on television and film or hear them on the radio, which obviously it's not really happening. For us, we define ourselves as Asian Americans. We call ourselves an Asian American dance rock band. And I think we wanted to be very deliberate about this and say, you don't get to decide whether we fit into this or not. We're making that conscious decision. And when we do it with knowing that we want to do it to kind of exploit some of these stereotypes, show them for what they are, and show how they don't always apply to all of us or, you know, millions of us.
Well, that's a good segue into some things you have coming up next, like the TED Talks. Well, you've given a few TED Talks so far talking about language and race, and you have one coming up in Salem in mid-September and another talk in Spokane in October, especially the one in Spokane. I don't know if it's a TED Talk or if it's a different.
Yeah, it's TEDx Spokane.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you call it Give Racism a Chance.
Yes.
Which is not to be confused with Give Peace a Chance. So why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was actually inspired by the community of Spokane when we performed there earlier this year, and just sitting down and talking with some of the students of color and saying how they were just were constantly facing racism, and the administration wasn't doing anything about it at their particular college. They had one half-time faculty member of color in a college with three campuses. They would have other students calling using racial slurs with the students, sometimes staff members, and no one would call them out on it. And because they believed that they were diverse, they're like, well, we have an employee who is black, so therefore we're not racist. And that was their whole rationale. And I just thought, you know, they're not even allowing this discussion to take place because they don't believe that racism exists anymore. They're like, hey, Obama was elected, racism ended in the country, and people have this mindset. And so I wanted to say we need to give it a chance to exist so that we can talk about it and what are we going to do about it, because it is an everyday reality that people of color across this country face. I'm really excited to be able to kind of talk about that and say, you know, it exists not only in, you know, when we talk about microaggressions, when we talk about the where are you from kind of questions, but also in our very public laws. I'm fighting a case right now with the trademark office. There's still a law on the books in Florida that people of Chinese descent can't own property. And when it went up for on the ballot, it was rejected. The people wanted to keep it on the books. They didn't want it removed because there's a scare tactic of like illegal immigration taking over and taking up all the property. It's absurd to me that in this day and age, we still have a law like that, and that the public refuses to remove it.
Right, that is supported. So giving racism a chance for the purpose of dialogue.
Definitely. Yeah, and I deliberately wanted to have a more provocative title, and hopefully it's a wake-up to that community as mm-hmm. well as other ones out there who don't even want to acknowledge its existence.
Right. Well, for our listeners, how can they learn about these talks and how can they attend?
Well, I would say to go to the TEDx Salem or TEDx Spokane websites, and you can register and buy tickets to attend, or they actually will be put on online soon, probably by the end of the year as well. So if you know, I would encourage people to watch, to like, to share them, because if you look at the TED Talks, I mean, up until the last few years, they were not diverse at all. They tended to be wealthy, tech, white individuals, overwhelmingly male for a long time. And it's only in recent years that they started allowing women or people of color to speak. And even so, you have these thousands and thousands of inspirational talks and videos, and so few of them actually deal with race or identity. And there's like less than 10 that actually deal with racism. So I encourage people to share them, to watch them, and say, this is a topic that's of interest to me. And to show the TED community that it is relevant as our human experience, and that we need to really work through these issues.
That's it for Stage and Studio. Thanks to KBOO engineer Janet Anderson. If you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on facebook.com/stage_studio. Or tweet us at @StageNStudio. I'm Sari Gamatha, sitting in for DMA Roberts. We're going to go out now with another song by The Slants, Con Kids. You can find out more about Simon Tam, The Slants, and their adventures at www.theslants.com. Or as Simon says,
you can just Google The Slants and find us all over, as well as many stories about our lawsuit.
I'm Sari Gamatha. Thanks for listening.
Kids say it's